You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What can we do about global climate change? Harnessing the wind to create green energy is one answer. The Michigan Public Service Commission tells us wind generation is the primary source of alternative energy in this state. But that means wind turbines, a lot of them. As of last month, Michigan has a total of 1,051 operational turbines, and there are more on the way. And while some communities welcome wind farms and the lease dollars they generate along with power, others push back to keep them out of their backyards. Sarah Bannis-Mills has worked with and studied many Michigan communities while they decide yes or no on wind farms. She's with Close Up, the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Great to have you here, because this is something that it's not going away. Wind farms are here. You can't miss them as you drive around into the Thumb, or even in Canada as you go along 401 outside of Windsor. You cannot miss them. And I know you've gone around the state. You've given presentations to 25 Michigan communities who are considering turbine development. What's your message when you talk with these people?
My message is that they need to think carefully about the pros and cons of wind development before they make their rules. So they need to know what they're getting themselves into or what opportunities they're saying no to if they decide not to have wind in their community.
Now, Michigan's first wind farm came online in 2001. Now we have more than 28, most of them in the Thumb. Briefly, help us understand, how do these wind farms operate? Like, who owns them, and what kind of lease payments and tax dollars can they mean for landowners and communities?
Sure. So usually the wind developer does not own the land that the wind turbine sits on. They own the turbine itself, but not that land. They lease it, have a long-term lease with the landowner, and that landowner gets paid. It varies, but they get paid for effectively the land that's taken out of production that they could have made by farming that, the money that they could have made by farming that land. Some wind developers also pay neighboring landowners for free access to the wind that blows over their property. They actually need that. You can't line wind turbines up right next to each other. The wind needs an opportunity to recuperate.
Okay, so it's got to be staggered, the placement.
Exactly. So they're paying neighboring landowners to make sure that they're not putting up a cell tower or something that's going to impede that flow. It also just helps to spread that revenue out so that more people have a direct financial stake in the wind farm. But beyond those landowner payments, the community also benefits, because the wind developers are paying property taxes. Some of those taxes go to the local township or to the county. There's also taxes that are paid to the schools, but this is one of the kind of things that I often tell communities about, that much like mine and your taxes, we redistribute school tax dollars on a per pupil basis. So most of those revenues get sent to the state and then redistributed in the local community.
It's not pumping right into the local schools. In fact, we'll talk about kind of positive misconceptions a bit later. So as we know, then, once an area is identified as a good spot for a wind park, community leaders have to make this decision, opt in, opt out, and people express their views pro and con. Let's take a listen to some people who are against turbines.
My name is Valerie McCallum. I'm a Lake Township supervisor in Huron County. I'm opposed to wind turbines for many reasons that would take too much time to go into, but the bottom line is they're an impractical alternative energy source in Michigan. They're extremely intrusive and costly considering the energy produced. When we need the energy the most on the hottest days, they're not even moving up here.
This is Kevin Martis. We oppose the placement of the wind turbines as proposed by Exelon and Consumers Energy in our township in Blissfield due to the massive size. We already had a existing height limit in our township that people were comfortable with for 40 years of around 40 feet.
My name is Norm Stevens. I'm from Carroll, Michigan, which is in the Thumb part of the state. And our township's job is not to conform to the wind energy's business model to make sure that they can install as many turbines as they want. The responsibility the township has is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of residents.
Sarah, how often do you hear sentiments and thoughts like these?
All the time. These are many of the things that come up, and they're some of the right things to come up.
What else do you hear?
So this in the last clip, there was some mention about health and safety. And so that comes up a lot because these are zoning decisions, and that's what local planning and zoning is supposed to do. Often there are concerns about property values that also come up.
And with that, probably tourism,
Right. So it depends on the kind of community that you're talking about. When if you're in a completely agricultural community, then they're not really thinking about that. Instead, what they're saying is this is a really good opportunity for my farm. Right. And sometimes you'll have farmers speak in support of that. These are the primary concerns, though, and particularly I want to get to the size because that has to go with the landscape change. Right. I sit on the Planning Commission in the city of Ann Arbor. And so whenever you have a Planning Commission meeting, people come to talk about what this is going to mean for their community and how this is going to change their community, right? And so, yeah, you cannot make wind turbines invisible. And modern wind turbines are 500 to 600 feet tall, particularly in flat landscapes. You can see that from quite a ways away.
So as community leaders are weighing these concerns, what, I'm going to flip the coin, what are some of the common positive misconceptions that you hear as you go around, that people think it's going to bring in like money to schools? You were kind of alluding to that.
Right. So that's one of the positive misconceptions. Another positive misconception is there's lots of talk and research about all of the jobs that are created from renewable energy, not just wind, but renewable energy generally. I'm not going to argue with that. In terms of the local jobs, the jobs that are going to stay in that local community, there are lots of jobs during construction, but not so many jobs that stay wind energy technicians, right? Yeah.
Once these things are spinning, I mean, it's kind of, you're right, they just need to be maintained.
Exactly.
So we've got this tug of war then. We've got concern over, you know, global climate change, a desire for green renewable energy versus these concerns that we've just kind of talked about, size and noise and changing the look of the land forever. How do you help local leaders walk through and address these concerns?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is putting it in perspective about which impacts are overblown. That was a bad pun and it wasn't intended to be.
But it's a good one.
Which benefits are overblown, right? So really trying to help them understand what you can expect. I bring to it the research that's been done in Michigan. You know, I've been in about a third of the communities in Michigan that already have wind farms to try to understand what do people that live there think about them? How has that changed their community? Because I think it's really important that you go into any big decision like this with your eyes wide open about either what negatives this could bring or what positives you could be leaving on the table by saying no.
So tell us a sense of for those who have said, all right, build them. Here they are. They're in the community. What worked as expected and what was perhaps unexpected for these communities that already have wind farms?
Right. So largely the decision to have wind development is an economic development decision. And so they were expecting economic benefits to landowners and to, again, the local government, to the local community. My research and a lot of what farmers will say is, yeah, we're seeing that. We're getting our checks in the mail. You know, the neighboring landowners are getting their checks in the mail and they're using it to reinvest in their land. And so they're seeing that. One of the perhaps unexpected things is that on the local government spending side, local officials have told me like, yeah, we're getting our tax payments in. But what we're using that for is to put towards our long-term retiree obligations, putting it towards long-term debts. And so local communities, the residents in those communities aren't necessarily seeing, like, they don't know how much tax revenue the wind developers are paying. And so that was something that was unexpected.
Okay. What else do you want to have people understand, especially the idea that people who are concerned about the way these things are going to look? What do you hear from people that have had them for a while? Do they get used to them?
Actually, earlier this year, Doug Bissett at Michigan State and I published a paper on exactly this to try to test. Do you learn to live with wind turbines, right? And some people do and some people don't. People who generally have positive attitudes, their attitudes increase over time, you know, improve over time. Those people who, particularly people who thought that the planning process was unfair, they actually grow to feel even more resentful of the wind turbines. One of the things in terms of the impacts that people point out is that they expected that their daytime landscape would change. What people didn't expect is the red lights at night. And unless you've been in the Thumb in the evening or driven up 127 in the dark, you don't realize that there is a blinking red light that the FAA requires so airplanes don't hit the turbines. And that you can see from quite a distance.
And you just have to, and they're not silent, are they?
They are not silent. Yeah. And I think that most people would know that going in, that they're not going to be silent. How much you hear them depends entirely on which way the wind's blowing and kind of what's planted in the field at that time of year. So more of the unexpected complaints, I feel like, have been about, like, we just didn't expect that we would be living in the red light district.
What about communities, when they're considering a wind farm proposal, what else should they look at? Are there alternatives? What about solar?
So solar is an alternative, and there are some communities that, Shiawassee County, for example, turned down a 200-megawatt wind farm but approved a 200-megawatt solar farm. Most of the time, it's not the same developer who does wind and solar, and so it's not like you can just choose which one you want. This was a unique situation where there was a solar developer in the ground at the same time as a wind developer. I think the other thing that's really important here is that these communities, with the exception of Gratiot County, which is an interesting example and we can talk about, are not seeking out wind development themselves. Wind developers are coming here, coming to those communities and saying, we think that your community has the right mix of wind resource and access to transmission, and some landowners who are interested in siting wind turbines on their property. And so what do you think, township government?
But tell me about Gratiot.
So Gratiot County, I'm a planner, right? Like, my PhD is in planning. So maybe to a planner, everything is about planning. But they decided early on that they saw wind development as their opportunity for their community to invest in the agricultural enterprise. So this was the way for farmers to make additional land. So they worked together and included it in their master plan before there was really a proposal on the table, and said, these are the rules that we're going to set. We want wind development here. They are not the windiest county in the state, right? But because they proactively planned, they were actually able to entice wind development to come there and have subsequently developed a number of additional projects. But that's the exception to the rule. Most people don't plan ahead.
And so they're reactive.
Exactly. They're reactive. And when you're reactive, you just don't have as much time. You don't have the opportunity to think about, like, what really makes sense. Like, my mantra to everybody is step back and plan. Think about what it is that you want in your community 20 years from now, 25 years from now.
And knowing that Michigan's public utilities, I mean, these aren't going away. They have to satisfy the state's renewable energy portfolio mandate and be at 15% renewable energy by 2021. I mean, so it's coming. And I think I hear you say communities being proactive gets you a lot further ahead than reacting once something's dropped in your laps.
And even beyond the RPS, I mean, that only goes through 2021. Most of the projects that would be developed to meet that are already in the works. Renewable energy, wind energy, solar energy are now the cheapest, or are cheaper, if not the cheapest form of energy. And so this isn't going away. What I've been saying to places across the state is that if you haven't been approached yet for energy development, you probably will in the next 10 years. So it makes sense to think right now about how not just wind, but also solar fit or don't fit with your long-term plans.
Sarah Bannis-Mills with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy. Close up at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.